Yes, everybody here and also the those visiting with us, we appreciate your presence. I hope you'll open your Bible study along with us. I don't know if you was like me, but June 6th, I found myself more interested in what was on the news, on the television, on the radio than a normal day. To tell you the truth, for a while, I really hadn't paid a whole lot of attention to the news, just enough to kind of keep up with what was going on. But on that day, I found myself really interested. And that's because it was the 75th anniversary of D-Day, the invasion of Normandy. And I got thinking about the fact that I can remember at the 40th anniversary and Ronald Reagan at Point de Hoc, and as he talked about the brave young men that scaled the cliffs in order to be able to attack the German fortifications. And as I talked about those things, that you just realized the significance of that event, of that battle, that Hitler had, basically Germany had the strategy, had the advantage of having Europe, and they decided to do what they call Fortress Europe, and that was to try to fortify basically all the coastlines so as to make the whole continent, basically all Europe, impenetrable. And of course what that meant is that for the Allied forces to do anything, they had to go in there and they had to attack someplace. And it was a real risky endeavor as you go through it. And we start reading about the number of people involved in it, that as young men get off boats, that there was over 130,000 soldiers that day actually went onto the beaches and parachuted out of planes. If you count the total number of people involved, all those from the pilots of planes to the people on the warships that were basically bringing the men so as to get on the Higgins boats and be able to go into Normandy. That you count all those men, it was over 160,000 men that was involved in a battle that day. And we start thinking about the numbers of this, just again, is amazing. 13,000 aircraft were involved that day. The 5,000 ships supported the operation. There were over 1,000 tanks that would actually be committed to this cause right here. And as you look at the statistics, it's just amazing and really inspiring in some ways and frightening in other ways. Of the number of people that died that day, the 10,000 Allied soldiers died. And I start reading about some of the particular events of that day that they talk about the first wave. And the first wave, 90%, actually about 92% of the men that first wave did not make it. And the second wave, the 80% of those people did not make it. And they had wave after wave of men coming ashore. It wasn't until about the sixth wave that actually the majority actually survived the first steps off those boats. That one statistic said that by the number of gunshots fired, the number of bombs that were lobbed that day, that one out of every four soldiers should have died that day. That's how much was going on. And again, as you look at that, you just realize that so much was riding on that day, that success. In fact, as I point out in the article, that Dwight D. Eisenhower, the head of the Allied forces, realized the riskiness of the endeavor, and he wrote a letter to the President of the United States stating his resignation in case the battle went wrong, in case they failed. And just thinking about that, and as I heard about that, and as I saw the men on the television, and those of that generation, and not too many of those left that were there, the stories about what they had done, it's one of those that can get you emotional. And I got thinking about those men, and as I thought about those men, that we just realized some things about them, and one is that those men left their homes to go to a very hostile place. Those men, whether it was people like H.T. that left Grace County, or Leon Stevens and Cass, Arkansas, and from small towns or from the farm or from big cities, it didn't matter. But they left their homes in order to go someplace else they had not seen before. And they went there not just to vacation or to enjoy themselves. They went there to fight against a hostile enemy. And again, it's hard to be more hostile. Have you seen the beaches of Normandy with the barbed wire there and the structures that were erected and the machine gun fire that was aimed at those beaches? Those men came to the shore. They were going into the definition of a hostile environment. And then as you look a little bit more about those men, you realize that they would die. Many of those would die on those fields that day. Again, a hostile environment. And not only that, but also, they were men. And I remember growing up in maybe the fifth grade or something along that line. So we kind of his first studies of World War II. And I remember seeing movies and reading books and seeing pictures of those men in that grade and later on in high school. And it kind of impressed me with something else this time when I saw some of these pictures. And again, I'm not sure if this translates very well or not. But when I was looking at these men, especially this young guy right here, you realize that they were just like us. And that is, they were often very young men. The U.S. policy was that they would not send anybody into battle before they were 19 years age. That Harold Allen talked about the fact that he had been drafted at 18. And on his 19th birthday, on that very day, he got the letter saying, telling him where he's going to be shipped off to. And his very first battle wasn't this battle here, but his very first battle was the Battle of the Bulge. And start thinking about being 19 years old, again, of coming from a place like Cache, Arkansas, being driven to the bus station, and your dad, as he lets you out of the car, says, well, go out there and have a good war. And that they were, you know, just young men, some of them 20s, early 20s. But they were not like the superheroes we see on television that can, you know, that could do fantastic inhuman things. But these were people that would bleed and die just like us. And then not only that, but also they were motivated by love. Now I know there's probably some people who say, well, they were motivated by love, by fear. And that's true. I realized when those guys got those boats and they had to go toward shore, their only chance of survival was to go forward. But I submit to you that a lot of them, the very reason they were there was because of love. And that as long as those men volunteered to go and fight, or they went into combat because they loved their families, and they knew that by fighting there, they were protecting their families back home. They were protecting the moms and dads and the brothers and sisters, and if they had children, they were protecting them too. And when they went on those beaches, that they were also motivated by another love, and that is a love for each other. A general, a number of years ago, explaining to the American soldier before the Iraq War, he said that our success and our victory in this war would not depend on our technology, our night vision, our super bombs. It's going to depend on our soldiers and your love for each other. Will you fight for each other? Will you die for each other? There were men that would sacrifice their lives, that would jump on grenades and go into the wall of bullets because it meant that others behind them could survive. They were motivated by love. And then not only that, but also if you look at those young men, you realize that they sacrificed, their sacrifice is real. And you see, you read some of the accounts of whether it's the soldiers that were parachuted into, I don't know what the French village was, but it's depicted in various movies as they were sometimes caught in trees and they were shot by the German soldiers, or whether it's Private Ryan as they shows the carnage of that day. But you realize that this was not some kind of hypothetical sacrifice. They were not asked to do something that was inconvenient, something that may have been just hard. They were asked to go out there and to fight a real threat and to die if necessary. And many of those men that survived that day would also have the marks of either physical scars of war or the mental scars of war also that they would take with them. And then the final thing I thought about when I was talking about this, that it kind of gets lost in history now. But he realized that the victory was not immediate. And it was not certain at first. In other words, looking back at it now, we say, well, that was the great battle. And yes, it was, but it took a number of days for the Allied forces to actually become entrenched on those beaches. And to be able to link those beaches together and actually have a foothold in Europe and be able to stage everything else from that place onward. But it took a number of days. You know, what if the Germans had been able to launch another attack? What if they'd been able to actually retake the beaches? And so it was
not immediate, but was certain that there was going to be victory. Well, I said all that, and if you read the article, you know that. And so I got thinking about those these things. And I titled a bulletin article, The Greatest Invasion, I think. Actually, my original title was The Greatest Invasion Ever. By the side, that word ever may not be quite appropriate. I'm sure there's others that would talk about other invasions during that same war that was pretty hard also. But as I thought about this, the greatest victory, and I thought about Jesus and about how we can relate these things to Him. And sometimes we may not do that. And one is that when we think about Jesus, we have to realize that He left His home. And His home was heaven. And the Gospels, and especially the Gospel of John, is laying out to us the fact of who Jesus was. And the Gospel of John, the very first chapter, the very first verse says, "The beginning was God, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And as John lays out the case for the deity of Christ, we have to keep in mind that He, from the beginning, but how can He have a beginning? For eternity was in heaven. The very place we desire to be at is where He left. When reading the book of Revelation about the splendor of heaven, again, I realize that we're reading a physical description of a spiritual place, but given so that we can understand the splendor of heaven, the beauty of heaven, all the things, and the great throne scene in verses 4 and 5 of Revelation, as all the angels and all the creatures in heaven are worshiping God, that's where Jesus left. Sometimes we may think it's hard to leave home. Maybe it's hard to leave home, your air conditioning and our king and queen size beds, and hard to go out there and camp for a week, or hard to go to a foreign country where they don't have quite all the same conveniences we have. But none of us have made that kind of sacrifice Jesus made. He left heaven. And as He left heaven, we find that Jesus and John 17 verse 5, it says, "Oh, now, Father, glorify me together with yourself the glory which I have with you before the world was." And the very glory of God Jesus possessed and actually gave up for a time period to come down here. And as John, the 15th chapter, talks about Him being the vine and the branches, the very source of life itself is wrapped up in Jesus. And so we think about Him. He left heaven, but He left heaven not so as to be treat it nicely. He didn't leave heaven so as to be worshipped as the king. He left heaven so as to be mistreated. That He knew, God knew, that when He left heaven and came down here, the way that He would be rejected by His people. When I think about the passages in the Old Testament, the prophecies, and about being betrayed by a close friend, and about the kind of death that's described for us in the Psalms that Jesus would have. When we think about the trial of Jesus and all the various passages, and Jesus says in Matthew 20, verse 28, He says, "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give His life a ransom for many." A ransom is a payment. It's something to satisfy the demands of something else. And so He left heaven so as to be that ransom for us. The second thing I thought about is that He became like us. And again, that's a concept hard to imagine. In fact, from the time of the death of Jesus on to the present day, there have been various theologians that have argued against this very concept. Because how can deity become like us? How can deity become a person? And so we have all these various doctrines that have come about through these years. And again, and the reason is because it's just real hard for us to imagine that very idea. And yet, in Matthew 1 verse 23, the angel told Joseph said, "Behold, a virgin shall be a child and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel," which is translated "God with us." Not the appearance of God with us, not the facade or the charade of God with us, but actually God with us. And so when we read about Jesus in the Gospels, we have to keep in mind that He took on His physical body. And so He would bleed, and He would get tired, and He would get hungry, just as we get hungry, and we bleed when we get hurt, and we get tired. That He experienced all those things for us.
And the question comes about, why would he do that? Man, why was it necessary to become like us? Well, the Hebrew writer gives us two points. One, Hebrews 4, verse 15. And there it says, we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. And that is, deity does not know hunger in a personal way. Deity does not know pain in a personal way. That Jesus came down here to experience those things. And because, and yet to withstand the temptation of sin. And so he says that's one reason, is that he had to be able to experience this here and to withstand that very temptation of sin. And the second reason is, over in Hebrews 2 verse 17, it said, therefore in all things he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Now again, propitiation is not a word we use very often. We don't say, well, my husband and I, or my wife and I, we got in a fight, so I needed to make propitiation now. We don't use that word. But what it really means is a peace offering. It means to satisfy the wrath of God in this passage here. So it'd be the idea that if we got into an argument, I need to make some kind of offering to you so as to soothe you, so as to calm you down. Now, what's ironic about this is the very offering that we're making to God is what God's provided for us. God's the one that provided the sacrifice. So the reason he had to take on the body of flesh is because he had to literally die on the cross for us. It wasn't enough just have the concept or the idea of a propitiation. How many times we say, you know, I intended to buy some flowers, or I intended to buy some candy, or I intended to do something that so as to make somebody happy, and we understand that really doesn't work. You got to actually do it. And so Jesus had to be a sacrifice. Now, the one thing that Jesus understood is that is the idea of sacrifice made to God. When we read in the Old Testament, all the sacrifices, the daily sacrifices, the bread sacrifice, the fellowship sacrifice, the peace offerings, when we read about all those things, they understood the idea that you sin, there's got to be a sacrifice. And that sin brings about death, there's got to be a sacrifice. That sacrifice was Jesus. And so he died, or he came down here and took on his body of flesh so that he could be our lamb offering to God. Then the third thing about him is that he was motivated by love. And I think we understand that very well in the Bible, because after all, how many passages talks about the love of Jesus, the love of God for mankind? Over in John, the 3rd chapter, 16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Whoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. Why give us such a great sacrifice? Why give up heaven? Why give up, again, what all he gave up, except for love? There are things we do for love that sometimes doesn't make any sense, economically speaking, at all. However, you do it because of love. Yesterday, I was telling some of you, we went to see a wedding. And the bride had this really strange request. She wanted to get married with her feet in running water in a creek. And so we drove there, and there was the bride in the water. But you know who was in the water with her? The groom. Now, I dare say that he had not grown up with that same desire. I don't think the groom had always thought, you know what, I can't wait to get married in running water in a creek. But he did it. He was out there with his pants and legs rolled up, and he stood out there, and they had the vows, and they said all their I do's. And I dare say the reason he did that is because he loved her. But we think about what Jesus did, again, what God has done for us, and the reason is because he loves us. And so we have Jesus, in fact, in John 15, verse 13, says, greater love has no one than this to lay down his life for his friends. Again, why does a soldier jump on the grenade? Why does a soldier be the first one to run through the door knowing there's possible gunfire as you run through that? It's because of those behind him. Because, friends, Jesus literally talking here to those who become the apostles. And he just wants us to know that when I die, it's because I love you. And that's something we have to keep in mind when we think about the death of Jesus for us. But not only that, but also that Romans 5 verse 8, which I often go back to because it almost is beyond comprehension again, that Romans 5 verse 8 says, but God demonstrates his own love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Can you imagine how ugly sin is to God, how repulsive it is to him, that he's perfect and he despises, hates sin? God hates transgressions. God hates sin. Yesterday, turned on Facebook and Lacey had the twins on there. And you know, they were on pillows and they were cooing and kind of smiling and they weren't saying much, but they were there and they were, and Lacey's talking to them and you look at them and you think, well, who couldn't love these little, two little babies? I mean, if you look at that and you did not smile, something's wrong with you, okay? Well, that's the way maybe we are when we're born, but whenever we sin against God, that's not the way we are. We're enemies of God. We're sinners. And I said, even though God didn't like us, he loved us. And so he's motivated by love. But then also, one thing about Jesus, that his sacrifice was real. Again, this was not some kind of theoretical idea about leaving heaven and coming down here and dying on the cross for us. Then we read about all this, that we understand that he lets heaven so us be mistreated by men, to be punished and to be physically abused by men. And we read about the trial of Jesus and all things went on during that time period. Luke, the 23rd chapter, verse 11. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt and mocked him and arrayed him a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. And you just read about the beatings and strikings and again, everything that goes on in that trial and up to the crucifixion. And it's hard for us to comprehend how cruel that was. That's why whenever the movie The Passion of Christ that came out in 2003, I believe it was. And people went to see that. And so many people, when they left that movie, said they never thought about how gruesome it was. Well, you know, that's something we maybe sometimes bypass a little bit. It's hard to imagine that. But you just think about somebody being beaten 39 times plus, because Romans wouldn't stop 39, as he scourged on the back. And as that whip would hit his flesh and tear the flesh apart. It's hard to imagine that. But that was a real sacrifice he was making for us. And as you go on through that, we find that in John 19, verse 31, it said, but one of the soldiers pierced out of the spear, and immediately blood and water came out. And again, he sacrificed all the way to the end, all the way to the death. And that, again, it's hard. You can't make any more sacrifice than that. And so his sacrifice is real. But then let me tell you the one last thing, and that is that not only did he leave his home in heaven, and he became like us, and he was motivated by love, and he has sacrificed real, but also he realized that his victory was not obvious. Now, I probably should put in here, not obvious to man. But it was complete. And that is, when those people were there, and you know, when those who had wanted Jesus crucified, when the Roman soldiers put him on the cross, and the crowd looks at Jesus as he dies, you had to think that the Jewish leaders thought, okay, we got rid of this guy. We've ended his life. Now we go back to everything being normal as we want it to be. But we look and we realize that that's the way they viewed it. And not only that, but also that when you read what the disciples did, Joseph of Arimathea, Luke 23, verse 53, they took it down, talking about his body, and wrapped it in linen and laid it in a tomb that was hewn out of the rock where no one had ever laid before. And we make the point that he put him in his tomb so that there could not be a mistake as far as about the resurrection. Nobody else's body would be in there. And so they wouldn't say, well, maybe the body had been misplaced or someplace else. But just keep in mind here, this was a tomb. This was because he died. And when the disciples left that day, they did not go out and have a victory party.
But then I go out saying, great, you know, the plan of God has worked. What they did is they went out and they were devastated. And you look over in Luke, the 24th chapter, and you just start there and just find in verse 1 on the first day of the week, early in the morning, and certain other women with them came to the tomb bringing the spice which they had prepared. All the way up to that morning, they thought he was dead. They were preparing for burial, and that was it. And so when you read through that, you just realize that they didn't understand what we now know, and that is that he wasn't there. That his victory was because of the cross, because of death. And that he rose out of the grave as the Gospels talked about. And on the day of Pentecost, when Peter is preaching to the people there at Jerusalem, on that day, that he points out to them in Luke 20, in the second chapter 23 to 24, it says, him being delivered by the determined purpose and foreknowledge of God, yet taken by lawless hands, and have crucified and put to death. And right there, that's what they thought was their victory, but he says, but God, or whom God raised up, having loosed the pains of death because not possible they should be held by it. See, there's the victory that we have in Jesus. And so when we think about what he did, it was complete. It was not a partial victory. The power of Satan had been loosened. The power of death and sin had been overcome. And because of that, we can have the same victory with Jesus in our lives. When we think about those men in Normandy and other places, Bill Cook, when he was talking to me before H.T.'s funeral, and he said, you know, those men were heroes. And he got a little emotional saying that. And he's right. Well, they're heroes. But realize that their victory is great, but the greatest victory is what we have in Jesus. It's what he did. And he did it for all of us. And so this morning, as we have the song selected and encouragement, we simply are imploring anyone here that has not obeyed the gospel of Christ to engage in that victory, to be a part of that, to have your sins washed away by the blood of Jesus as you're baptized for forgiveness of your sins or added to his body. If as Christians we need our prayers, the prayers of each other, we're here to aid each other in doing that. If you need to respond this morning, what you can afford is to stand as we sing.